We're off. Okay. Thank you, Tanya. And hello, everybody. My name's Marcia Murphy, and I am a member of the board of ODF, and I am a practicing consultant in org design, and it's my great pleasure to be hosting today's session, the first of this three-part series. Let me start by introducing Amy and Greg, who really are very well known, I think, across our field. They are two of the most prominent and highly respected people, like figures, I think, out there today. And over the years, they have really led the way in developing and advancing the practice from their development of methodology that they have shared so freely, to their teaching, to their mentoring, to the authoring of the many books, to their conference speaking. They've been very present in the field for many years, and we've all benefited from that. And between them, they've clocked up several decades of practice. And as many of you will know, they came together in 2010 to set up Cates Kessler, their global design firm that they grew and built until 2020 when it was acquired by Accenture. And they're continuing to contribute generously to the field, and they have another book coming out in October, which is part of the focus of these three series, a big part of the focus of this three-part series. I've had the privilege of reading the manuscript, and it's going to be one of those reference books that you have on your shelf and you go back to time and time again. It is a really rich read. It's packed with their personal reflections of the years that they have been working at OD and the wisdom that they've acquired over those years. And it's very much aimed at the practitioner, this particular book. And with that, it is packed with a whole range of what a whole section that's called the playbook, where so many of their frameworks, methods, techniques are in there ready for people to lift it and use, with a lot of examples of how that's worked for them with different case studies. So it's a fantastic contribution to our field. This series came about from a conversation of, I guess, timeliness that when Amy, the book conversations had with Amy to start with, where the book was with the publisher, and ODF had just released its research report. And we started talking about the crossover, the commonalities, the differences that that was showing. And then that turned into, as I say, this three-part series. So today we're focused on the profession and the practitioner. The next session will be in September, and that's going to focus on AI and the changing business context that we work in. And then the third session will be in November, and that will focus on methods and tools and techniques. So, Amy and Greg, thank you so much for joining us today. We're looking forward to getting started on it. But just before we jump in, I want to give you a brief outline of how the session's going to run. So we're going to start by hearing about how the book came about and why it matters now. Then I will share a selection of the findings and insights that came through from our ODF research into the practitioner. And then Amy will pick up with what makes a great org design practitioner. And then we're going to move into a more of a conversational discussion about a few topics, and that will take us probably through to the hour. Now, I know some of you will need to drop off then, but Greg and Amy are sticking around for another 30 minutes. So if you can and you are able to and you're interested, please stay on, because we'll move into more of an informal Q&A type session in that half hour. The last thing I'll say is, please, we've got a lot of people, I think, on board today, which is fabulous. Please, any questions, observations, thoughts you have, do drop them in the chat, including anything that you might want future sessions to touch on or you're particularly intrigued about. So we will be, as I say, referring to that later, but we will, it's also quite a really good source for us as we plan the parts two and three. So let's begin. I'm just going to load this up. So we're going to start, and I'm going to ask Greg about why you and Amy wrote this book, and why now? Why it's so important now?
Great. Well, good day to everyone on behalf of Amy and me, and thank you so much for joining. A few quick thoughts. Amy and I stepped back actually from decades of serving our clients to refresh the five milestone design process that was featured in the first book that we did more than 15 years ago. John Wiley Publishers reached out about doing a second edition of that blue book. It sounded fun. Because we've learned so much since that went to print. But we decided after starting that project, no, there's a new book here, and one that should be much more focused on the practitioner. So the new one is a capstone to more than 30 years of doing the work that builds on that five milestone process, updates it, and then pulls together all of the best thinking in a how-to kind of way, with many of our favorite tools and frameworks attached to each of the steps in the design work. We wanted to get as many of our favorite frameworks and tools into one place as we could. So the playbook that Marcia mentioned is a place where we have got those placed. And in fact, we're working on a website that will launch soon where all of that material will be available in a PowerPoint format for practitioners to download at their will. This is really all about giving away. Amy and I are both sort of finished with the commercial part of our career and are much more interested now in sharing what we've learned and really doing that in the sort of open way that we've tried to do over time. Okay, so if we take a look then at slide three, Marcia, just a few thoughts and then I'll hand it back to you. This is a special time. And, you know, along with the disruptions that have already started, I don't think there's any question that we are looking at an extraordinary window for growth ahead, where advances in technology, digital platforms, biotechnology, connected products are creating all kinds of new sources of value. New business model innovation is just, it's going to move very, very quickly. More than ever, capabilities are at the center of the design problem that we face. But those capabilities are going to be very fluid because of the uncertain nature of how AI really is going to impact business. And so experimentation will be key to taking advantage of these new growth opportunities, serving customers in more personalized ways, scaling faster than before. And there is an operating model gap in that regard. This is our problem to solve. Strategy people alone don't have the chops to solve this. General management can't do it. If we go to slide four, Marcia, the level of change that we think sits behind this work that we're doing now means rethinking the entire operating model across all elements of the STAR model, eliminating unnecessary boundaries, rethinking vertical hierarchy in order to really create much more ease of horizontal ways of working, designing in more integration across the boundaries. Customer boundaries, geographic boundaries, functional boundaries, business unit boundaries, and defining roles that are radically empowered at the edge, while making certain that humans are controlling the work of machines. And we're going to talk about that a little bit more later this morning. So this really is an extraordinary time, and closing that operating model gap, we think, is the context for all of our work going forward, and certainly for this new book. Marcia, back to you.
Okay, thanks, Greg. So I just want to share a few highlights that are relevant to today's session from our practitioner survey that we ran last September and October. And the report was published earlier this year. I might just ask Tanya if she'd be kind enough to pop the link into the chat in case people want to go to that. It's on the website. We did it to establish a baseline of, who's doing org design, how it's being done, where it's being done, What are the drivers of it? All of these things to get a stake in the ground for where the practice is today, and to provide something that would be quite a useful baseline to check and keep tracking over time. We asked about a whole wide range of things, but as I say, today we're just going to put out a few of those. First of all, the respondent profile, just so you're aware, we had 207 respondents to the survey, which was, and it was quite a long survey. The proportion of external consultants and in-house consultants was very balanced, and we find that actually with ODF, with a lot of our community events, that that's the case. And we had some academics, and we had a very small number of additional people. The majority of people were working in the private or for-profit sector. About 75% of them had worked there. And they came from actually a quite a global background. So around half from the United States, about a quarter from Europe and the UK, and then the rest were sprinkled across other regions of the world. We the group, we found a very experienced group of people. So 77% describing themselves as experienced or highly advanced. And if you that was validated by the we also asked about years of practice, how long people had been practicing organization design. As you can see, well over half had been 11 or more years, and 71% over 7 years. So we were hearing from a fairly experienced bunch of people. This won't be surprising to people, I guess, but the survey findings certainly brought this into sharp relief, which was this notion of the hyphenate practitioner. And the question that drove this was about how the degree to which, org design was the core practice or skill area for the practitioner. And as you can see, 43% it was their primary expertise. Which meant that the majority of our respondents were practicing org design alongside other activity. And some of that activity, when it was we can cross-reference that to the we asked people what their role titles were. And this gives us a little bit of a glimpse into what other type of work, the adjacent type of work that often sits with org design. The grey bars in the background, this shows that we with this we did this was an open text response, so we did a thematic analysis of the to cluster up the role titles. They're not mutually exclusive, but broadly just to sort of look at the different categories of titles that people had, and there were many of them. But you the grey bars denote the proportion in relation to each other. So the highest proportion were executives or founders of businesses, then org designers, so off and so on. And so the executive founders, for instance, was about, I don't know what that is, six or seven times people who were working in workforce planning. So that's what the grey background is there. I think it'll be very interesting to monitor this particular question over time to see whether this changes at all or whether it stays fairly stable, this sort of practice of some people specializing primarily in org design, but many people working as a part of their sort of portfolio of skills. There was a little bit of difference between people who were in-house practitioners and external practitioners for this question. So externals were 50% of them were practicing primarily in org design, and for internal in-house folk, it was 32%. So most in-house people were doing this work alongside other things. In terms of industries and the breadth of industries spanned here, we used a standard classification index, the US index that's commonly used, or adapted that slightly. So you can see across all of each color is a particular industry category. So OD, the work that people had done in the past 12 months had spanned a whole range of the full range of the options available. And the top ones from the right were technology, professional and business services, the dark blue, manufacturing, the green, finance and insurance, the brown, and consumer goods, So, interesting, the ones that were most mentioned in terms of which industries have you worked with in the past 12 months, they tended to be tech, knowledge type, professional services type firms, although not exclusively. It's interesting that the minimum across all of respondents, we asked, which industries you'd worked with, and no one had, whether in-house or external, had worked with less than two. So two was the minimum, and actually the average for the for internal was something like, I think it was around about two and a half, three, which I found interesting that, that people are saying they're working across that many industries. In terms of the spread of organizational size, most common, just over half were working with organizations that had, we measured by employee numbers, just over, who were working with companies that were over 10,000 employees. But actually, there was a full spread across all sizes. Keeping an eye on the clock here. This one is from, if you can't see the writing, it's broadly each bar is going from the broadest sort of unit of analysis that the focus or scope of your org design work over the past 12 months was focused on. So at the top, we have ecosystem-wide, where it's beyond a single enterprise, tracking through to a team of teams, second from the bottom. And again, people are working across a whole range of scope, though the most common is hovering in the middle with the enterprise and business unit level. So we also asked who sponsored your org design work over the past 12 months. A lot of our questions were framed in relation to the past 12 months to keep it current. And as you can see, the top ones were a chief executive, and followed by a chief people officer, followed by another couple of C-suite levels. So the numbers in the bars are the number of mentions. So, of course, any respondent could have mentioned any number of these. When you take a look and pull out the six that are C-suite, the C-suite leaders accounted for 67% of their category mentions. So I know that's a slightly contorted way of describing it, but it's not necessarily projects, because we didn't quite ask that. We asked who had sponsored the various work, and you could have had multiple sponsors for one project, or you could have had one sponsor who covered many. So that's why that's. But it certainly indicates that org design work is sponsored at a very senior level in the organization. We also looked at who led the organization design projects. And interestingly, about a third of in, you would expect that mostly in-house people led in-house projects and vice versa. But we had quite a bit of crossover. So around a third of both roles had worked on projects that were led by the other. So, for instance, an external consulting working for a project that was led by an in-house, and the other way around. So there's clearly quite a bit of collaboration that goes on, and that could be an interesting thing for us to explore a bit more. One of the things I found quite striking was that about a quarter of respondents to this one had worked for projects, org design projects that were led by people who did not specialize in org design. Moving into what were the drivers of the work, whole range of different drivers, but the top two were operational improvements and a change in strategy. Again, these aren't mutually exclusive, but we put up these categories that people could choose from. And I think what the full report goes into in a little bit more detail, but it is quite interesting how these cluster together. And you get which you know you get you'll get where you get, for instance, a mention of change or shift in strategy, it was always coupled with these the other selections, and they all contributed in one way or another to operational improvement. So there's sort of some quite interesting cross checking we can do with that. This one was how often do you reconcile the impact of your org design work against your against your intentions, so the outcome against the intended objectives of the work. And I think it's again really interesting that so many people are doing this. They're either always or usually. And I think that the portion of those for whom it's less frequent, sometimes or through to never, sometimes that can be not surprising in our line of work because depending on how you're engaged, you may not get to see things through. Finally, just the last couple of slides here, we asked about what the most significant challenges were in doing the work today, doing organization design work. And the blue denotes the relatively the proportion the number of times that or number of respondents who mentioned these things. So client buy-in very clearly at the top and the leadership and everything that goes with that. But a whole quite a range of things that are getting in the way or be or that have to be overcome to do great org design work. And coupled with that, the future skills that people that we asked what would add value to your practice. And again, this is the list of things that people mentioned. Again, quite a wide range of different things. And something that this is particularly interesting for ODF and others because we can really start to focus our service offerings more in relation to some of these things. As I say, we asked about lots of other things like the use of technology, where people felt the future is evolving in terms of both the practice, but also the form that organizations are taking, methods and techniques and so on. We'll come to those in subsequent sessions, but I think that just giving a quick snapshot of some of the findings here leads in quite nicely to what Amy is going to address, which is their reflections on the what makes a great org design practitioner.
Thank you so much, Marcia. And yes, as you mentioned, it was during the time that we were writing the book, and as Greg said, we were writing to the practitioner and thinking about what makes a great practitioner, that this wonderful piece of research came out. And it was just a moment in time where we were reflecting on this, and it felt so much like we have a profession now. We have a discipline. And we were thinking deeply, and that's how we reached out, and this all came together about what is at the core of what it is that we do? So before we joined Accenture, Greg and I had hired and worked with dozens of colleagues at Katz Kessler. We worked with and taught hundreds of internals over the years. You know, we always knew sort of intuitively who was great at this work, who had potential. But it wasn't until we got into Accenture and had the experience there that we were really forced to articulate it. And over the 4 years, we brought about 150 consultants into our group, the Accenture Operating Model and Org Design Group. And we trained them. We had an intensive fellowship program. We had a training academy. We did a lot of self-directed learning and, of course, on-the-job coaching as we delivered on our client projects. And that experience was really, really helpful to make clear to us what makes for an excellent org designer. So, Marcia, let's just go a click and I'll take you through our perspective, and it'd be great to have a conversation later on what you all see. So, if we go to the first, there's a set of attributes, and we would say these are kind of hardwired. They're about how you see the world, they're your motivation to do the work. So what we see, it starts with a deep, deep curiosity about how complex systems work, not just about people or teams in isolation. As I was listening to what Greg was saying and the challenge that is at us around this operating model gap in a time of disruptive technology, yet again, this curiosity is what drives us to find the answers to what are the organizations of the future. And therefore, we need to be comfortable with ambiguity and abstraction, really coupled with a desire to make that abstract tangible using models, using visuals, using the tools that we have to help leaders really articulate their organization of the future. The third is a diagnostic or orientation, an instinctive search for patterns, for root causes, interdependencies. And we'll talk more about this rather than just application of existing solutions, because we are going to be at the forefront of creating new solutions from what we know is universal and true for our clients in the future. And I think most importantly is a passion to make better work environments, true empathy for employees, and coupled with an appreciation of the unique stresses that are really faced by leaders today. Now, these are the skills. So these are sort of the tests. I think of them as a screen. Like if you feel this and this gets you excited, you're an org designer. Now there are a set of skills, and I think these skills can be learned. We find that some are easier than others, and we've ordered them here in what we think are hardest and easiest to learn. So Marcia, we can just go for one more click. So hardest to easiest, the systems thinking. This is something you can practice and you can learn to do. Again, it's helpful if this is the way that you see the world and its complexity. Translating the abstract, AI is helping a lot of us articulate the visuals and the graphics, but this is still a skill of being able to take many options, complex information that is sort of three-dimensional in its character around what an organization is, and then render in a way that people can get their minds around. The curiosity and creativity. Poise is an interesting one. Let me just say a little bit about that. We were searching for the right word. This is something about our own sense of confidence and control in very high-stress situations. What we find is, as organization designers, we are changing power systems. The work we do changes people's jobs, the trajectory of their careers. We have to create confidence for leaders to do hard work. And we have to have humility, but also confidence in our work to help our clients have that confidence to go forward and make that change. We can't do it for them. So we call that poise. And then we have some other skills, business fluency, executive facilitation, and really managing programs and projects and seeing all of that work through. Then finally, we think about two competencies. As all competencies are, these are only built over time through intentional practice, feedback, reflection. And this is where having peers to work with really pushes you to make a difference. When Greg and I would coach each other over the years, it was usually about these two topics, and the kinds of things that I so appreciated having a partner like Greg, doing the work with me. And they're really about diagnostic excellence and being seen as a trusted advisor. And that trusted advisor is an interesting one, because when we think about when we are at our best, we bring all of these competencies and skills to create a successful org design project. And the three elements of really diagnostic excellence, knowing how to co-create options and outcomes with those who have to own them. And think about the art of orchestrating participation and then building that trusting relationship with the client. So again, they are motivated to do the hard work of change and embrace possibilities. So let me pause there. Marcy, I know you have a lot of a number of questions for Greg and me to respond to, and maybe we can get and then into those.
Absolutely. Well, I'll stop the share there if that's. Would you like me to keep this up, or while we have a
No,
conversation,
let's see
I'll
each
pop
other.
that down so we see each other. Yeah, and I'd add that the book has, you had written a lot about what you were just describing, Amy, with the role of the practitioner, the skills, the attributes, the competencies. There's a lot of material you have in the chapter, which is really interesting to read in depth. One of the things that I really when you're talking, you're looking back at reflecting on your years of practice and experience and what you've seen work. And there's a lovely line in the book that says, new organization consultants often underestimate how much clients assess how you intervene, not just what you recommend. And I guess that the how, of course, it's always been important, But I get from the book that that it's becoming more important now. So could you talk a bit more about that, how and what it is and why that matters? And also whether you see any differences between the how in relation to the internal in-house consultants, practitioners, and external practitioners.
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm glad you picked up on that. It's interesting. If I go to your last slide and you mentioned the biggest challenges, you said the biggest challenges in the research are things like buy-in and leadership mindset, implementation and adoption, time, budget, capacity constraints, strategic and systems alignment. And it's interesting, how do these challenges actually show up to us? You know, we hear them as the client tells us they have a clear strategy, they know the problem, but they're not willing to admit the leadership team isn't aligned. Or they want really fast answers to complex issues. Or our clients say they want to change, but they're not really committed to seeing the hard work through. But listen carefully to all of this, because these all come through as failures of our client. We hear this from our colleagues, we heard at conferences. Look, we Greg and I have made these complaints about exact complaints of ourselves, of course, as we've worked on projects. But this is what I've learned, and where I would challenge you is that changing those challenges is all about being that trusted advisor, and it's earned. You can't demand it. If you're external, you know, just the proposal and making the sale, that's not yet earning it. That's not enough. You still have to earn it in the project. And if you're internal, you know that's even harder. So if your client doesn't trust, right, doesn't trust you, if our clients don't trust us or they don't trust our process, if they don't give the time, resources, and commitment, it's not on them. I think it's on us, right? And this may be hard to hear because it feels like it's something out of our control. It's about them. But setting change up for success is really the essence of our work. And it's hard. This is something that we, why I love the word practitioner, because we are always practicing. Each project, each intervention, each the way we engage with our clients, even if it's just a simple start to the project or it's a meeting, communicate something. So here's what we believe makes a difference, what you can do. Number one is have a methodology. You have to have beliefs about how to change a system. You have to have a core approach and be able to articulate that. You need to give your clients confidence so they can do the hard work of org change. Number two is you have to bring insights. It's about listening and bringing value to a diagnostic. We are not just process consultants where we just feedback what we've heard. Right? We make sense of these signals, of the data. We turn this overwhelming noise into something that's actionable and manageable and can be implemented. And those insights also build confidence. And that said, we, of course, don't come with answers, right? We provide informed options, make the design work a learning experience. And that gives our clients confidence because they feel that they are doing it and we are helping it. Them not doing it to them. This is about very much the how. And I think as a profession, there's some things that we can do, which is all about this education. You know, as Greg said, we're all about giving it all away. And it's to our colleagues and to our clients, because the more that we all share content, examples, show the impact, not in the sale, not in the project, but before the engagement, helps to create, right? Clients that are ready for this. And I think the internal practitioner often doesn't have opportunity, make opportunity to do this enough, right? The externals think about it as marketing and brand building. The internals have to do this also, that education. The internals can also do a better job, I think, of contracting, being clear what the process is, and being very clear, knowing where adaptation is appropriate. But what's the line for a process to have integrity? And I think for all of us, this is a journey of building influence. It's about incremental progress, and particularly for internals, every engagement, you get in a little bit earlier, you're a little bit more strategic with your questions, you build influence and credibility, you deliver on what's asked, and you add value beyond the presenting issue. And so for our own development, you know, I wish I had been more intentional over the years about this. I think it can be accelerated with intentionality, but it's something we do individually, and I think as a community, as a discipline, we can also do.
And one of the things, I mean, so it's as with so many of the helping sort of professions, it's all about relationships, right? And I know, and in your book, you talk about, I guess, moving from the deliverables and the output so much through to not, they're still important, but the sort of stewardship, that ability to take to work with a client in a really trusting way and navigate them through a journey that you might not, you know, neither of you will necessarily know the outcome of.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's not becoming friends with our clients. It's about really giving them insight, and confidence again to do this work.
Greg, thinking about the organization designer of the future, I'd like to turn to your thoughts on technology, data analytics, AI, and the role that's going to play. It's very we're going to be, you know, doing a deeper dive on this in the next session, but we can't go past it today. With specific and it relates to both the role that AI plays in the practice, the method, the techniques, the approaches that the practitioner uses, but also the way that organizations are needing to change and evolve to integrate AI. So on both sides. So specifically, Greg, what skills do you think are needed here? And you mentioned in the book that, of course, we can't know the art, you know, we're at a point in time where AI is still unfolding, and we can't know precisely what it's going to look like in the future. But for now, what would you recommend that practitioners need to know, what they should be thinking about, and how they could start to really build that knowledge and those skills?
Good. And I'm going to focus more on the substance around the client deliverable for a few minutes, and then just a brief comment on our work and AI. I think that we make a strong case in the book for thinking hard about how the human plus machine vision needs to come together. Let's use slide 19 here, Marcia. This image is courtesy of Paul Doherty and a lot of great work that he's done. The research shows that leaders are very unclear about what AI can do and what it can't do in the design of work, never mind the design of the enterprise. And things are foggiest in this missing middle, this piece where human and machine are supposed to meld, and you're supposed to have augmentation that really captures the strengths of both human plus machine. Hence the gap. Researchers at MIT, there's just a ton being published in that space, insist that the solutions are going to come from experimentation, that no one has the answers yet. Companies need to set a culture for this collaboration between human and machine, between people and AI, in the design of structures, processes, metrics, roles, decision rights, everything we know are part of an effective operating model. Our role is to help drive shifts in behavior and changes in culture that align against a purpose-driven view of this technology, which would be something that gets us away from use cases, which is mostly what we see going on right now. We're talking instead about enterprise-wide rethinking of the organization against an intention, a growth objective. How much tech know-how is needed to do that? Well, we think that to close this operating model gap, designers have to move from being tech-aware to much more tech fluent in order to apply our frameworks with relevance. Here are some examples. One, at the enterprise level, you're designing how the enterprise makes decisions, how it allocates capital, and so forth. AI now sits inside those decision processes. So knowing something about how AI gets employed in decision making is fundamental. Which of those decisions can be augmented, which might be automated? And how do decision forums that we're designing need to be rewired when the layering of decision making and the monthly cycles way of thinking about decisions goes away? When it really does become real time and decisions are happening more where the work sits. I think we have to understand that clearly enough to be able to rethink those decision forums. Second example, know something about how data architecture needs to shape organizational architecture. Know something about what it means to design for data aggregation and management, where AI actually lives in the center, while at the same time enabling much more empowered access to data out in the organization, and what that means for the role of the center versus the role of businesses or the role of distributed functions. I think we need to understand that to make those kinds of design choices. A third example, if you're working at the business process level, then you better know something about who owns an outcome when an agent approves a transaction or denies a claim, an insurance claim. So you can help design the work of humans to oversee and actually control those outcomes. We need to get better at bringing in technology subject matter experts to co-design these new ways of working. I, for one, don't want to learn all of that technology myself. Thank you very much. And this co-design methodology is something we should just be, that should be core to the way that we work. Let's go to slide 20 real quick here. Amy and I feel very strongly that there are core design constructs that are even more important than before, but that do need to be adapted because the learning curve will be going on for years. So, as an example, help leaders make conscious design choices that have a more modular nature that will enable this ability to flex, to make continuous changes as AI evolves. So, we've used this model for years, but we're using it differently now. And now we're using it to get clear about, all right, what are the components of the organization that should remain stable over this next, what, 2 years, 3 years? And what are the components that probably will not and therefore will need to be continually adjusted in some fashion? So the back of the model represents the center. So things like data and analytics are going to live there, certainly for a period of time. And then those businesses that sit in the middle, new franchises, big development programs, those are the ones that are going to need to adjust very, very quickly from an org design point of view. And I think frameworks that we've used in the past have to be reconsidered, but still have enormous relevance in the way we think about these things. Implementing AI at scale is impossible without radically cleaning up outdated processes, rethinking the metrics and rewards, retooling the workforce, and moving to this culture that really values experimentation. And we think that human-centered design is the only way to make that change sustainable. Designing for empowered people, people who control what AI ultimately delivers, is at the core of that. Now, in our design process, we've got to get skilled at using AI in our own work. This whole thing of analytics and using data, just it accelerates so dramatically and really beautifully with the help of AI tools that allow us to take 50 interviews and reduce them to a set of themes that we can really work with. And we've all got to get better in using those tools and those skills, no doubt about it. Those are my thoughts. Marcia, back to you.
Still thinking about skill and knowledge, Amy. Another in the book, another area that was really called out was business fluency, and that it did come through in our research as a development need, but it wasn't a sort of front top runner. It was middling. I think most people would agree that if you're going to do great design and have credibility, you really need to understand the machinery of the organization, how it creates value, the sort of commercial and financial elements that underpin that. When you talk about business fluency, what is it that you're specifically talking about, and why is that so important?
Yeah, well, I would pick right up, Marcia, on what Greg was just showing, the front, middle, back. And you think about something around product development, and so many products have technology as part of them. And I love that you're showing, like, applications engineering is now in the front, because it's we often see that those folks are actually changing the consumer and customer experience, almost daily. And how is strategic marketing, product development, and engineering coming together into, is it going to be a new function, or is it just going to be a tight team? So there's a piece of understanding business, of really, really understanding the work and how the work is changing. And not all of us can be experts in that. But again, I think it goes back to our curiosity. What are the things that you're reading, and what are you following? And even to be ahead of this, and to be able to speak with your client about what they're seeing on the ground real time. So when I think about the practitioner, then I think it goes back to our discipline. And if we're going to see org design as a true discipline, then we need to know where it sort of sits in the world of the tools, like a general manager, a CEO brings in. And we have commonly said that we see it sitting really right between strategy and org development. So let me say a little bit about that. So if strategy is about how to win, and the strategist brings data-informed options and certainly facilitates alignment about them, but often we see the strategist expected to come with at least recommendations and often answers. And then conversely, org development is all about human systems, team effectiveness, and change. And the org designer has to be fluent in both. And again, I think our experience at Accenture helped us sharpen some of our thinking. So at Accenture, we brought lots of strategists into our practice. And I mean, amazingly deep analytic and business skills. They understood business models, they understood industry, they understood benchmarks for a function. But what was curious to us is once after we were tasked, we understood our work then was often to hold them back from starting with a solution or starting with best practice, for them to learn the art of discovery and co-creation that is so important to our field. Then on the other hand, as we work with many internal org design partners who come from an HR background, maybe an interest or experience or training in organization development, the challenge is a little bit different. It's more about how to build credibility by speaking the language of the business and how value is generated in the business. And the work here for the HR leader who wants to really be an org designer is then to get beyond what's often symptoms, unclear roles and responsibilities, or interpersonal dynamics, and then really see deeply into the business model and how strategic choices impact organization patterns, and then how we think about this. So as org designer, we draw from both. We have to speak the language of the business, and then as Greg said, is to keep that sort of human at the center, understanding human systems and how strategy and technology is impacting those. Honestly, this has always been true. It's only more so today. And this is what I think is just so exciting and so fascinating about our field, and why it's so exciting to work in this juncture.
That's really interesting. And how it must have been great to have ex be addressing that and sort of working that out when you, as you say, working with your new Accenture team with their very different backgrounds to work out what is the nature of the, how do you get that middle bit right?
Yeah, no, Greg and I learned a lot there. We ourselves became so much more industry knowledgeable, technology, process, systems. I mean, things that, a firm like Accenture and other big firms are so good at, and really brought an appreciation. Whereas before we might have said, oh, we don't know, you're the expert here, that how do you mesh that expertise together? And so, again, our discipline is sits and draws from so many different areas. We've colleagues who come from engineering and those who come again from, socio-tech design, and it all adds to it. And our role is always to be bringing that knowledge in.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, again, we're also our last session is going to be looking at techniques and methods and models. But I have a question to Greg about the STAR model, because we can't go through today without talking about the STAR model. And it was one of the questions we asked in the research was, what tools and methods do you use? And it was by far the most cited model or framework, with 55% of our respondents mentioning it. And equally interesting was that there were very, very few example models or methods that had been developed in the last 10 years. So a lot of the methods that people were using or the frameworks tended to be in existence a long time. So two quite interesting things there. Now, obviously, the STAR model wouldn't still be being used if it didn't have real staying power, if it didn't still have that great sort of enduring utility and application. But in the age of AI and technologies and the whole context that we are moving into in our world, do you think it needs a modern overlay? And if so, what might that look like? And could you talk about what you think its enduring and absolutely relevant strengths are, but equally where you think, if there are any, where you think we need to stop using it in that way?
I love this question. Let's go ahead and put the model up on the screen in the form that Amy and I are using it. We've thought long and hard about this question, and the Accenture experience was challenging relative to the model because of the pressure to incorporate technology into everything. We've argued, Amy and I have argued with each other over the topic over the last couple of years. We are completely aligned now, by the way. So there are people who would suggest that STAR is a relic or a pre-digital artifact. Jake Abworth was was a deeper and a really bigger thinker than I think a lot of people understand. In any case, it's a mistake to think about it that way. It confuses the model's level of analysis. STAR doesn't describe tools that an organization uses. It's a meta framework. It sits above tools. It defines the logic, and I think this is really an important point. It defines the logic by which an organization focuses and sustains the right behavior and action against a strategy. Galbraith's wisdom was that he was an engineer, but he was a true behavioralist. That was the roots of the model, and it was its intent in its application. Technology and AI do not change those facts. What they change is the environment, the speed, the complexity, the information density within which the organization has to work. Decision speed dramatically changes, as do the economics of capability, which we really need to think about. And so those new forces drive new design choices, many of which we haven't even begun to think about yet. AI raises the ability of designers to produce new insights. When AI shifts the capability requirements, process, people, metrics, structure have to adapt. But the organizational componentry that we are designing is largely the same. Systems have interiors. Star is that interior logic with regard to organization. Technology is one of the external forces that the organization has to adapt to and with. Now, as a practical matter, and largely for optics purposes, Amy and I have agreed to add technology to the process star point to highlight the fact that new ways of working must incorporate technology. And practitioners will adapt the model. They always have, they always will. The question should be for what purpose? Paying attention to STAR as a way to think about behavior change is the indispensable logic that it always was, that can power radically new and very different ways of designing the organization. The human imagination is not limited, but is empowered by frameworks like STAR. Back to you, Marcia.
Long live the star. Very good. Okay, well, we're coming up to the hour, and I am going. This is the point where we will just transition from this backwards and forwards conversation into more interactive question, and we'll look to the questions that came in through the chat. I just want to remind people, for those of you who do have to drop off on the hour, that we'll be firming up the dates for parts two and three very soon, and you'll be hearing through the normal channels when they are starting to come out. I hope you've added anything in that you want to particularly explore in any of those next two sessions. But at this point, for those who are leaving, thank you very, very much for joining us today, and we really hope to see you at the next session. And on behalf of you, I want to thank Greg and Amy once again for giving your time and your preparation, as you just keep doing actually over the years, to keep helping progress and advance the whole practice of org design. So farewell to those of you who need to leave, and great for those of you who are able to stay. And we'll now just look to the, we'll see just roughly how many people are going to be able to stay on, because that will sort of make a little bit of a difference to the way we might want to interact here. How many have we got? 151, which gradually
Yeah, I
dropped.
was given a moment as we transition, and I've
Yeah.
been looking in the chat, Marcia, and
Yeah.
very wonderful comments. And it's amazing to really have such a community that, we all love the work and do the work, and so many people who have the opportunity now to do the work and see these comments. Not too many questions, so we'd love to get more questions in here. I mean, there was one at the top. Do you ever see Compass, a hyphenated org designers? And that's interesting. Greg and I have done a lot of teaching, like internal in-house workshops for the HR organization. And that usually starts with, well, can you train our OD team or maybe the HR business partners? And we always encourage, hey, bring along, your talent folks, your L&D folks, but also your compensation people, because they are at the end of the chain here, having to do job analysis, job architecture, thinking about when we do get to org charts and reporting and all. And as work changes, jobs, roles are going to change. I think compensation, how we motivate, reward people, very, very important. So we love and we always appreciate when we have comp people in these programs, because they really bring a very practical perspective to it. Okay, good. Now we've got some questions, some other questions coming in.
And there's just while you're looking at ones you'd like to respond to, someone's asked when the book is coming out. So when will it be available for purchase?
October 1.
Okay.
So I'll pick up this question around reference to horizontal alignment. Expand on what that looks like from a practical standpoint. The simplest way to think about that, the context of that comment, Janet, was this notion of designing the vertical, simplifying hierarchy to power more horizontal ways of working. And Amy and I have been sort of on this for a couple of years. We started working on that idea when we were doing the Purple Book, and we are both just very strongly connected to this argument that the more that we create layers, and certainly the more that we retain decision-making processes and forums that rely on hierarchy, the harder it is then for cross-business teams, cross-functional, cross-business unit, cross-geo, harder it is for them to work together because everybody's sort of looking up, waiting for decisions to get made. Plus, it just creates enormous complexity. We worked with a client years ago where we discovered this in spades, where we figured out that a big part of the problem in getting a global brand team to be able to work with product and brand people out in the regions in parts of Europe, parts of Asia, was that if you have layered marketing people, the people who own a product category don't know who to work with in the horizontal out in the countries because there are layers of marketing people that they have to persuade. There's a group layer, there's a division layer, there's a country layer. And so we just think there's a huge amount of benefit in spending time thinking about how I designed the vertical to power the horizontal.
Yeah, it's a great question. And Janet is one of the business leader who has become an org designer, which is really great to see. Another way to come into the profession. We welcome. I love this question that Sarah has raised here right under there about, should the STAR model be, calling out decision making? And as Greg noted, if what we're trying to do is push decision close always to the customer, close to the edge, how does that change organizations? So Jay Galbraith would say that the purpose of an organization is to make decisions, essentially. That is the essence of its machinery, is better, faster decisions, right, are what make one company better than another. Right. So two companies, same industry, same products, customer sets, technologies, right? What does one do better than the other is good and fast. And they have to be good, right? High quality decisions that take in all the data and make sense and make the right trade-offs. And fast is that they are timely, right? And we all know as we work with our clients, those two things are often in tension and what we're helping them to actually resolve. I think it's interesting now we have a little perspective. We can look back at COVID and we'd say, which of those companies pivoted? They saw COVID as an opportunity to try a new business model, a direct-to-consumer, change the way they delivered their products or services, and which didn't, right? The internal assets might have been the same in each of them, but it was the ability to make decisions. So it is not a piece of the STAR model. It is very much, though, part of our process as we start to think about the architecture of the organization and then the seams and the interfaces and where value is created in the organization. That is where all good decision-making tools apply. And what Greg was pointing out earlier is what we're seeing is that finding the decision nodes is changing with AI because there are these places where a process of, is this the right amount of inventory or what should be pricing or what does this, consumer signal even mean or what do we put on the shelf for a customer? Some of it is now driven by AI decision making that can be actually, generated, automated, but then figuring out what is the human piece, the trade-offs that need to be made, and who in the organization, what functions need to come together to actually make that decision, that hasn't changed. So our work will continue to be helping organizations make good, fast decisions, even if it's human and agent together.
Can I
I'm
come
going
in?
to.
Oh, sorry, go on, Greg.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm going to a different one. So if you were adding something to Amy's comment.
No, I was going to go ahead and take the next one here. So Brandon's question is a really good one, and I was looking at Amy Wilson's question as well, and I think they kind of go together. So I'm going to take a stab at both of those. So this one around how star models is sometimes not used effectively or can be misused. There are three things that come to mind there that I think are really useful. One is to underestimate the benefit of having real clarity around what the strategy choices are that sit at the top of the model, because you can't align if you don't have, the other star points, if you don't have real clarity there, and moving on too quickly, allowing management to sort of get away with generalities leads to a weaker product at the end of the day. The second is capabilities often not getting the attention that they need. Really thinking deeply about what are the muscles that have to be built to deliver on that strategy still remains a challenge. It always has been. And I think that's going to be even more difficult going forward because the capabilities are in such flux right now. And the third would be overemphasizing structure. Again, old news, right? Really underestimating the impact, especially of metrics and reward systems, which people are uncomfortable with and often skip over it, get into a big announcement, we've made a big organization change. And I like Amy Wilson's question about as this evolves, how we think about culture in the mix of doing the work, and the reference here to treating it as an afterthought. I think Amy and I both feel really strongly that culture is not an afterthought. What we did have to convince clients of early on was that there is no culture star point because there is no culture button to push to change the culture. Culture is shaped by the other star points. When we change strategy, redefine roles, delayer organization, get different leaders, those things are how it changes. But rather than thinking of it as only an effect of effective alignment, what we argue strongly is that putting effort into defining what culture you expect to have or that you seek is a part of the strategy star point, in effect. When we're getting that discovery thing done and we're trying to get a leadership team to really nail down what is this all about, what are we trying to accomplish at the end of the day, we think a set of culture markers are part of that outcome that we're designing for. So it happens in that earliest process, not as an afterthought.
Yeah, I want to pick up on Zach's question. Zach, thank you for it. Zach is one of the people on LinkedIn who I always find very provocative when he posts something, and always find myself giving it a like. So you asked the question, you say, especially in the last 5 years, nearly every one of my OD initiatives have centered on reducing cost, is you don't need a design process. Downsizing by design, our colleague Jillian Echender. Curious what strategies and approaches people have used to get clients into a design mindset. So this is a struggle that we've had in for years. Greg and I, we don't do restructurings where you just know you're going to lop off a piece of the organization to save cost or But cost and efficiency are always part of a project. And in fact, we often encourage our clients to put some boundaries on that because, the easiest thing for people to come back with from a design team when they're trying to solve a problem is, well, if we could only add more people, or if we only had these assets, or if we only had another group doing this. So, the inclination when we design is to create. So we actually find constraints actually make more creative solutions to problems. That said, if the client is only looking for efficiency, then part of the coaching, and this is part of that relationship and trusted advisor, and depends on the relationship you have, but is to encourage them to start to think about capabilities. Yes, we can save costs, but what would you like your organization to be able to do better at the end of this work? Because it's going to be an investment of time and energy, and they're going to do it anyway. Hey, what would you like to be able to do better? If you think 3 years from now, what might be the challenges that the organization should start building some muscles around now? And what we find is that helps to get into a future-oriented capability building kind of mindset. We don't say, no, we're not going to help you be efficient. You got to answer the question, right? And you got to help them meet whatever they're doing. But what we find is if we start to ask questions in our diagnostic, if we start to also, as we're looking at efficiencies, start to create options around these new capabilities, it creates an energy, right? And it changes the mindset from we're trying to fix something to we're actually building our future together. And we find that if you do this, it takes a little practice. This is part of the skill. If you can do this, it really unleashes energy and gets your clients to broaden their thinking a little bit.
So just connected with that, I think, Amy, what you're describing is very much about strategic, future-focused, directional conversations. And Sean has asked about touching on the business model in your outline, and we talked about the STAR model in relation to it being a powerful org design framework. Would you recommend, or how do you approach when you're needing to unpack the business model in order to design for that?
I'll take a stab at that. Love that question and love those challenges. The context that we've tended to work with most often, and we've done some writing on it, is this idea of how you design for both the old and the new. We think that's the core problem to solve. Around shifting business models, where the scale of what exists today is how you generate the profits that make the business succeed. And so you still have to be able to do that stuff. And so then, as these radically different business models that are largely technology driven come into play, what is the right way to create separation and focus? For those new business models, while at the same time keeping them connected where they really need to, where scale still really matters. But then really thinking hard about the developmental cycle and how in the very earliest stages more separation is important, and really making sure that we're not putting profit and loss measures or asset measures on these precious new ideas. And so we really like the idea of teasing them apart by thinking about what is the old, what is the new, on the new, what is the time frame expected around actually getting a product or a service into the market? How do I measure the success? This is really all about metrics in these early stages. How do I measure what success looks like with a very new idea when I can't measure it on profitability? What kind of staffing do I need to think about? What kind of structure gives it that sort of separation? It's a big topic, but those are the initial thoughts, and certainly a place where we think more attention needs to be given. Established companies just don't do a good job of this. They are great at killing new ideas, and I think org designers can have a lot of impact in changing that.
That links, I think, quite nicely to if it's Jan or Jan. I'm sorry if I don't know how to pronounce your name, but has said, Greg, curious about your thoughts on ambidextrous design and about how you sort of run the company and change the company at the same time. I think they're referring to there, which is, I think, exactly what you're talking about.
And that's going to become so much more important as the numbers of changes in these business models, when AI really starts to be something more than use cases, and it starts to be something more than productivity, and really becomes new path to growth, the numbers of these are going to be exponentially, and we have to design for that.
I mean, organizations, and that's what's, again, I think fun about this is it's there's always these polarities, right? It always has to be ambidextrous. You have the money maker of the current and the new of the future. You have groups that are focused on, short term and others that are building for the long term. You have the center and the field, these tensions that always have to get the both and. And that's part of why I think going back to those skills of curious about complex systems, but able to manage what is ambiguous, but also the abstract is What turns us on as designers is trying to get that both and to try and solve the puzzle of how can we be efficient and build capabilities and be innovative at the same time? How does one part of the organization then become a feeder into another part of the organization, and we're connecting them all together into a whole while at allowing then, each part to have that kind of focus that we know as human beings we really appreciate. That's the design, and doing this with something that we literally can't see, right? That's beyond and above all the human beings, is really some of the magic when our clients start to imagine and see that organization and see the picture and see those dynamics, then we know we've done a good job. And it is really helping them embrace being ambidextrous, polarities, now and future.
This question that Sarah Taffy has put in here is a really tough one, and I think it's worth puzzling for a minute. In the C-suite, org design conversations about AI, very theoretical, hard to evaluate, pressure to cut bodies, replace with AI, suggestions on making conversations more concrete. Wow. I'm glad I'm not an insider anymore. A couple of thoughts come to mind. I don't have a solve, but a couple of thoughts come to mind. It seems to me that there are two different ideas that are oppositional that somehow we need to bring together. I'm making this up, okay? There is the matter of experimentation, which I really do buy into. I really do think that the way companies learn is going to be by trying things and not bet the farm things, right? And some of those experiments really should be pushed beyond productivity. And so strategy people need to be part of the conversations with technology people, with org design people, with human resources people who are really puzzling this notion of, hey, how about we find ways to experiment with ideas that really are about growth, about generating new sources of revenue? So experimentation, that's one idea. The oppositional then is we all want to understand what our future is, right? We all want to set a vision. We all want to lock in the long-term answer to the problem. And I don't think that's entirely wrong. I think the idea of while we are experimenting, being able to sink some stakes in the sand around how we imagine as a leadership team, and I think leadership teams should spend lots and lots of time conversing on this. How do we see an AI-powered XYZ company 3 years from now, 4 years from now, and really try to characterize it in terms of new businesses, what it means for revenue, what it means for productivity, and what it means for for our operating model, what it means for the way that we organize and how we manage and how we think about people. And so those two different ideas, experimenting over here and trying to sink some stakes in the sand around a future state over here, they seem sort of opposing, but I think they're not. And I think that I want to see more experimentation, but I like the idea of doing it against some flag that's been stood up out there that represents our beliefs about where this is going. And is it adjusted? Of course. But the idea of just throwing use cases out there, that does not appeal to me at all either. So I think somewhere it's that mix.
I totally agree. And it relates a little to the question of just above that Annette has about, I guess, what you were talking, stimulated this question is, horizontal structures can become complex, and you grow and you put on mechanisms and governance, and you're trying to tie it all together. And it's this whole idea of, we call it unrewarded complexity. It's it's complicated rather than complex. Complex is good because, you know, a complex organization reflects a complex ambition and strategy, but when it's unrewarded and it's layered and it's just sort of accrued and accreted over time. And I think these experiments that are unconnected are going to create the similar kind of new kind of complexity inside. Part of our work sometimes is coming in and helping to simplify, not to make things simplistic, but almost to come in fresh and clean and ask, well, why is this? And why does it need to be this way? And do we need to start fresh? And what is the purpose, or as Greg said, that flag out there? What are we moving toward? And is this serving us? And it might have been a good idea to try this, but now it's become the monthly meeting that is no longer serving us. And so whether it's governance, whether it is interaction, you know, models, whether it is complex metrics or other kinds of processes, or even, you know, ground up, let a thousand flowers bloom activities, used to be innovations, now it's AI, it's going to be something else. Part of it is coming in and helping to get back to the core. What's the essence of this organization, its purpose, where it's going to? And then let's really examine fresh what is serving that purpose and moving us forward. And it's almost very refreshing often to clients when you challenge them in that way. We may not have the answer, we don't know what that is, but freeing them to think about it can be very valuable.
Yes, earlier on and well back in the chat queue, there were one or two comments about, or we've talked about frameworks, but also language. And I think a huge part, you've both spoken about this before, but a huge part of what org design practitioners bring is a way of comprehending the system in a way that is not often found elsewhere. And I think that's something to not underestimate, because to be able to frame something and sort of put your arms around it, know the relationships and all of the parts, and a way of thinking about it is such a massive contribution, actually, even before you get near the process of the design or the solution, the design solutions you might come up with. I think language is really interesting.
And maybe, Marcia, we could begin to wrap up by answering a whole bunch of questions that are in the chat about, you know, how people learn and how to get connected and, you know, where to go from here. Because I think we'll go through and get the content questions and for our future sessions. And somebody asked, you know, what are Greg and I involved in? Yeah, commercial, obviously, ODF is the core of our professional heart here, particularly in North America. EODF is the counterpart in Europe. Organization Design Community, despite its very casual name, is actually the academic professional organization. In the fall, October, going to have a 2-day online conference, and that brings together academics and practitioners. So those are three really, I think, the core kinds of places to learn. We are going to be doing, as part of this book launch in the fall with colleagues, a public program, a training program. We used to do them through Cornell for many, many years. Cornell moved away from that. It's going to be a new version, relaunched, all virtual in the fall. So we'll, you know, share information about that. And we're excited because we're doing it with a number of colleagues who we call our next generation, five or six who really we've worked with over the last 10, 12 years. And we'll be leading that, we'll be guest speaking at it. So some new opportunities coming up. And I think, you know, for people, as Greg said, we're gonna launch a website with the book. Put all the tools and frameworks on there, and hopefully that can be a useful hub. And you know, the ODF webinars, and going back, you know, if somebody is new to the profession, going back into that wonderful resource of past events and listening to many of those webinars can be quite useful.
We can, I think there's a lot of connections going on, which is fantastic in the chat, and we'll capture that, and we can do a bit of steering too after after the session to connect people. I know that ODF has set up a group that is, that it came out of the conference, that's looking at ways of more people engaging, connecting, lots of ideas there. And part within that suite of things, there are a number of people who are taking the lead on setting up local groups and so on. So we'll sweep through and see how we can help people with that too. Can I ask you one final question, both, which was, and it's a bit different from all the things we've been discussing, but someone earlier on said, as a very new entrant into this field, as a new organization design practitioner at the front end of the career, what should they be doing? Could you just give, off the top of your mind, one or two tips or pieces of advice that you'd give someone starting out in their career?
Well, obviously, reading is going to be important. People, I guess, don't buy books much anymore, but there are still some great books that people getting started should read. And most of Jay Galbraith's books are a good place to start. The new book that Amy and I are going to have, I think, is going to be sort of a way that some new people can get started, because it's going to be such a reasonable consolidation of thoughts. The book that Amy and Jay wrote, the green book that Amy and Jay wrote, is still a very, very practical guide on organization design that's recommended. So those are some thoughts that I'd share off the top, in addition to being part of the kind of affiliations, the kind of groups that we've already talked about.
And the thing that I would add, and what I saw at from again from our experience at Accenture, that accelerated people's learning was really to find a peer coach, somebody maybe a little bit ahead. And as you do the work, to be intentional before you have a client meeting or you're doing an assessment or an offsite or facilitating something, to go through it with a coach. After you do something, to debrief it, document it, right? Here's the case of what I've done. Just that act of being intentional, thinking about your own work and learning from it. Here's what I learned, here's what I do differently. Present it to your peer coach, say it out loud. What was the process I used? What did I learn from the client interaction? What did I learn about org design? You start to build your own library very quickly. And it goes from, learning from someone else to actually learning from yourself and having that peer coach. And again, here, Marcia and Tanya, to help connect people who are geographically based, but find someone to share your work with. I think that, when I found Greg, that's what changed the quality of my work, to be able to have him coach me and give me feedback on my work, and it was mutual. And at Case Kessler and Accenture, we did that extensively. That increased the quality of my work when I met Greg, because of that. And I would encourage everyone to find a partner like that.
Lovely. Well, on that note, I think it's time to wrap up. Can I thank you again, Amy and Greg, very much for the what you've shared with us today, and in advance of another two sessions to come. Thank you also to everybody who has joined this conversation and who has been able to stay on. Fantastic. We'll be mining what's in the chat to so it's not all gone when the call's over, and we hope to that will inform future sessions. Before we close off, Tanya, is there anything else that needs to be said?
We did post a couple days ago that we're going to have an open board of directors seat here as of this month. So if there's a self-nomination process, if you're interested, take a look at the home page of our website and you can click to link to that. We have other events that are coming up in July. June's been a very busy month, and we tend to slow down a little bit over the summer. So keep an eye out on upcoming sessions. And I will stay online here if anybody has questions about the community as a whole that I'm happy to answer. Otherwise, I wish you all a great rest of your day. And Greg, Amy, Marcia, thank you so much for making the time to be here today and twice more yet to come this year.
Thanks.
Thank you all,
Everybody.
thank you. Marcia, time.